This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 11 o'clock. Coming up next on Stage and Studio, they preview the 10th Annual Fertile Ground Festival of New Works.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, January 21st, Clinton Street Resistance will screen King, a filmed record, from Montgomery to Memphis, a historic documentary, nominated for a Best Documentary Oscar in 1971. The screen benefits the Children's Book Bank. Again, that's King, a film record, showing Monday, January 21st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Portland, Oregon Old Time Music Gathering from January 16th through the 20th at various locations around Portland. The Portland, Oregon Old Time Music Gathering aims to celebrate and enrich the community of traditional old time Appalachian style string band musicians. There will be jam sessions, a Cajun honky tonk night, concerts, dances, workshops, and performances. Again, that's the Portland, Oregon Old Time Music Gathering from January 16th through the 20th at various locations around Portland. Location and age restrictions vary. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to Stage and Studio on KBOO Portland. My name is Joseph Gallivan. I'm sitting in for DeMay Roberts this week, and we're here to talk about Fertile Ground, the Festival of New Works, which runs January 24th through February the 3rd. My guests today are Nicole Lane, she's the festival director, Bill Wadhams, Samson Searoth, Aaron Wheeler Kay, and Jessica Wallenfels. Thanks for coming into KBOO.
Thanks for having us.
So I'm going to start by talking to Nicole, Samson, and Jessica. Nicole, just tell us what Fertile Ground is. It's the 10th year. I think people are familiar with it. I'm sure every actor in Portland is somehow in it because there's so many shows.
It's a pretty extraordinary festival. Yes, it's our 10th anniversary festival. This year, there are more than 75 events, 120 acts of creation within those events in theater, dance, circus, music, animation, and multidisciplinary arts. And this year's festival, there are 42 producers at 39 venues across Portland. And this goes on for 11 days. And yes, there are thousands of artists of all sorts who are involved in the festival every year, but certainly this year. And what's really exciting is there are thousands and thousands of audience members that come to check out these brand new works of performance.
So not everything in this is a finished show. There's a lot of readings. There's sort of people who've written the first act and they're going from with that. What are the rules? You know, what do you have to have to get in the festival?
Well, it's pretty wide open, and it's really intended to be like that. It's intended to be a platform for new work at any point in development. So it is work that could be a stage reading. It could just be a reading. It could be a workshop, or it could be a world premiere. And this year's festival features all of those things. And that goes for dance as well as theater, as well as animation and the many other things. So art is a process. And I think people who, you know, exclusively go to the shows that are piped into Portland, they're seeing a very, very finished, polished project. Whereas what Fertile Ground does is it helps educate audiences about how exciting the process of creation is.
So you might see something here, and then in 2 years you might see it again, finished on a big stage.
Oh, somewhere. Yeah, absolutely. We have a number of shows that are in this year's festival that have gone through the process with Fertile Ground, and others that went through a process elsewhere and then have come to Fertile Ground. One of the most amazing things about the Fertile Ground Festival is it gives artists a launching pad to develop a new work and get it up on Portland stages. But even beyond that, it allows that work to go and grow beyond Portland. And over this past year, I worked with a lovely volunteer who's also an actor and writer and producer, Lilo Alfaro. And she went through the past 9 years of festivals and looked up every single production that's ever been done in Fertile Ground and charted where they went. It's in an extraordinary catalog of the work of Fertile Ground in our community and far beyond. She found that there were 70 Fertile Ground originated works that went out beyond Portland. They went as far as Avignon, France, and up into the Canadian fringe, and all across the United States. What we're doing here in Fertile Ground is something that really brings eyes back to the amazing work that's being created in Portland and giving these artists an opportunity to get out and seen and produced.
Do people write for the festival? Do they target their work and, you know, they know January's coming up, or are they just like, oh, I got this thing and let's do that?
I think it's a little bit of both. For people who know, really have been involved in the festival in the past, they target the festival as a place where they can try something out. Even if it's the first act or it's a set of music. A lot of musicals are really hard to develop. And so that is something that musicals in particular do, is they'll test out some music and they'll you know, kind of figure out how that plays in terms of the story as well, or the book. So it's an opportunity for everyone, and it's just really exciting to be able to see just things grow, because you're really watching that happen.
If you're a listener and you want to see a lot of stuff, you know, get immersed, what's the best thing to do?
Well, there is a festival pass, and I know that I can't mention how much that is on air, but it is very reasonable. And you get that pass, and then you go in and you reserve as many shows as you can. And there's a limit on pass holders per show, so you got to do it quickly. But you know what? Fertile Ground is really about going what I call a creative adventure.
So, Samson, you have a show called Here on This Bridge.
Yes.
And it's part of a particular project. Just to fill us in, because Dime, who normally presents this, is connected to the project.
Yes. So Dime and I are a part of Media Rights, which is a multicultural organization, award-winning, and we have a project called Theater Diaspora. It's the only Asian American theater company in Oregon, and we've actually been around for about 5 years, and Here on This Bridge, the ISM project, is our first full production. It's an original production consisting of 6 monologues exploring intersections of race, gender, orientation, and national origin. It's directed by Catherine Ming Duffley. She is a teacher and director in town. She teaches at Reed College. And so the ISM project arose when we noticed that there was a lot of racism, sexism, all the big isms that are going around. We wanted to analyze that and really put a lens and see what was going on. And so we put a national call out for monologues, and we received a tremendous amount of really great works and narrowed it down to six. And some of the pieces, most of them are actually local writers, such as Josie Seed, myself, Yasmin Rabalcaba, Heather Raffo, Bonnie Ratner, Roberta Hunt, and Dime Roberts, actually. And then our entire cast is made up of a wonderful selection of actors of color, really great Portland all-stars such as Shireen Jacobs, Sophia Molina, Shelley Bichelli, Dre Slaman, myself, Larry Toda, and Jane Vogel.
Who's Heather Raffo?
She's the only writer who is not local. She wrote Nine Parts of Desire, which I actually saw in college, and I've been following her for a really long time. So the piece is actually about an Iraqi mother dealing with school shootings, her reaction to Sandy Hook, and basically her worry about her children and the future of the country because of everything that's going on and the fear.
Mm-hmm. And okay, is she presenting or is she?
Dre Slaman is actually presenting that piece.
Samson, your own piece was written in response to your visit to Laos to meet your family.
Yes.
So just tell us about that.
So actually, the Portland Civic Theater Guild presented me with the Leslie O. Fulton Fellowship, and it gave me the opportunity to travel to Laos, which is where my family is from. And it was the first time I ever went back to visit. And after visiting, I was able to connect to my origins, talk to my mom about her past and what we went through. And so she gave me the information to write the monologue dealing with her as a refugee, really learning about her past. And it also gave me the opportunity to share my experience coming out to her as a gay man.
When you're in Laos, what is the action based in there? Was it about coming back and
no,
talking in
the action itself is a recalling of a conversation between my mother and myself. My mother lives in Arkansas. So after I was able to visit Laos and really see what it was like, I was able to experience the river where she had to cross as she was escaping the Khmer Rouge.
Mm-hmm. What was it about Laos now when you were there that sort of made you feel at home?
I honestly can't explain the feeling. As soon as the plane landed and I looked out the window, there was a familiarity. I couldn't describe it. It just felt like I was home in a way, even though I had never been there. And the people seemed to accept me in a way that I've never really been accepted before by strangers. And so they didn't feel like strangers to me. They felt like family.
So you're going to do a little piece from the monologue.
Yes. So my piece is called See Her Strength, about my mother. For the protection of my brother and sister, my parents had to flee Laos, the country they called home. I will never forget the moment my mother told me the story about how they escaped to Thailand. It was weird hearing her voice in such a different tone, and even more strange that she started talking about her past because she never did that. My family's past had always been an enigma. It had been tucked away behind old photographs and tightly sealed lips. That was why my family moved to America in the first place, to escape their past and to give my siblings and me a promising future. She told me about how my sister was just a toddler and my brother was 5 or 6 years old. She was pregnant with me, but she didn't know it yet. As she told the story, I looked into her eyes. I could see her reliving every dreadful moment. They were on a small boat crossing the Mekong River to Thailand. My mother held us close, my brother and sister and an unborn me, shielding us from a barrage of bullets. She risked her life to protect us. To me, that is the opposite of weak and helpless. That is a hero.
That's amazing. When you're performing this piece, what are people going to see on stage? Is it just you, or your props?
We're actually workshopping and rehearsing. We just started rehearsals today. And as we're working through the blocking, there is a square of turf, and there's going to be chairs. And the blocking will be intersecting between the two. There may be one person on stage. There may be several people on stage. Kate Duffley, who's directing, is actually figuring that out as we go.
So the six monologues, the actors could all be up there together?
Yes.
But there's no interaction between you?
No, there's not much interaction, but there is a thread of empathy and connection between all six monologues.
Mm-hmm. And just quickly, what are some of the other stories?
So Josie Seed has, her piece is about being a black actor in Lake Oswego, which is very, a lot of people know that it's a racist city, but for some reason, nothing is changing. And it's about the fear and stress of just being. It's called Being Me in the Current America. Yasmin's piece is about her mother's travel to become a citizen from Mexico. Heather's piece is about being an Iraqi mother, her response to Sandy Hook, and the fear of the country for her children. There's also the diversity thing by Bonnie Ratner and Roberta Hunt. It's about a black tradeswoman and having to go through diversity training in her field. And the last piece, Harvest by Dime Roberts, is about Oregon exclusion laws in perspective of an Asian American. It actually opens January 24th, runs until January 27th. We take a week off, and then we start again February 7th through February 10th. And it's at PSU's Lincoln Hall Boiler Room. You can go to mediarights.org for tickets and information. You can also go to theismproject.brownpapertickets.com.
Jessica, your show is called The Undertaking.
That's right.
And this is I was struggling to get my mind around it. It's dance, it's movement, it's a play.
Yeah.
What is it?
It's a genre-busting piece, honestly. I'm a director choreographer, and I live in the space in between theater and dance, and I have for many years. So lots of my pieces, including The Undertaking, deal with music and theater being combined, but in unconventional ways. So in The Undertaking, we've taken Dmitri Shostakovich's Piano Trio Number 2, and we're sort of using that as the spine of the piece that was the original inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful piece. It's very complex and difficult. It's a famous piece. There are four movements. And so I'm working with writer Emily Gregory, and she's written scenes, is in the process of writing scenes that will go in between these movements. So the piece kind of functions a little bit like a musical in that, you know, when the emotions become too big, we burst into song. But instead of singing, the actors switch into movement as their storytelling mode.
So the basic story is it's an aging mother and the people around her.
Yeah, just one person, her daughter. The piece has two actors or actor movers and three musicians in the trio. So it really just focuses in on a mother-daughter relationship within the context of end-of-life care.
What's the personality of the older woman who's dying?
Delightfully crotchety. Like most older people that I know who find themselves in that situation, she feels she doesn't belong there at all. She thinks she's not an old person. She doesn't see why she's being treated in the way that she is by her daughter. And what's going on in her head and her heart has nothing to do with the institutionalized settings that she finds herself placed within. And I think even when she knows that death is coming, she might feel some sense of peace, but a greater sense of unease and maybe apprehension.
Does she express herself in song and movement?
Not in singing, right? So it's just dialogue, spoken dialogue, and then movement.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And in some places, we will be overlapping dialogue over the music, which will be an interesting experiment for everybody Some classical music lovers out there might take great offense, actually, if they find us speaking over the music. But we had my company co-produced another piece for Fertile Ground a few years back called The Snowstorm, which was set to 20 Rachmaninoff piano solos played live on stage by Eric Nordine. And that was a really successful layering of story and music played on stage.
So how do you choreograph for someone who's over 70?
Well, she's an incredible mover. So I choreograph with awesome gratitude, actually. Yeah.
Was there anything different you had to do?
Well, we're in process. The way I work with any actor is to find out what their strengths are and to find out what's inside them, what beauty is there. So in some ways, no, not different at all. But in other ways, every single person's body is different. And it's about finding out what's there.
Can you tell us a bit about the actual story? I mean, how these two people interact?
We sort of open on finding them in a hospital. And it seems that the mother has fallen when she was alone, and that was difficult and dangerous, obviously. The daughter's concerned about her living situation. Then we dance about it. And over the course of the piece, we sort of travel institutions from a hospital institution or a rehab institution to assisted living to hospice.
How do you make a hospice exciting on the stage?
Well, it's pretty dramatic, honestly. You know, those situations are kind of our last chance. Right, to tell people that we love. And it's such an awesome, terrible task to try to communicate to your parent, you know, what they've meant to you and realizing finally what they've given you. A lot like what Samson's monologue was just discussing, is like, there's no way you could ever thank a parent for everything they've done for you. And you know that that's the case when you're in hospice, but you also may be carrying a lot of snags and pains, you know, as we all do, from growing up with that person. And of course, we know our parent-child relationships are all that complex, you know, full of beauty and pain. And when you're in a hospice situation, you know that that's kind of your last chance to try and give voice to those things.
They have hospice, they have end-of-life doulas now, don't they?
They do, yeah.
It's an actual job?
Yeah, yeah. There's a group in town, actually, who recently screened a film about that. I'm trying to remember their name, and I'm not going to.
Mm-hmm. So in your story, how do you keep it dramatic without it being too realistic? You know, if someone's dying, obviously the communication's going. How do you get that dramatic sort of climax and keep it?
Good question. And I think it's also a subject that can easily go, you know, really sentimental or melodramatic. What's amazing about this music is that it can always lift us into metaphor. So while the scenes may come off somewhat realistic, although I like to tell Emily, I think they're sort of in the vein of Carol Churchill, so not quite realistic. Wherever we may be when we're speaking dialogue to one another, we could definitely lift off into what movement gives us, which is sort of a different three-dimensional realm of expressing relationships and gestures and partnerships to one another. So I think we have this awesome, modernist, scary and terrible and dissonant and exciting music to push against when we go to those places. I'm so happy to be collaborating with a phenomenal local ensemble called Northwest Piano Trio. They consist of Hannah Hillebrand on cello, Heather Mastel Lipson on violin, and Susan McDaniel on piano.
What's the set like?
There's no set. Well, there is a set piece, I should say.
Yeah.
And it was created by the brilliant Kay Blankenship. I don't want to give away too much, but in the same way that we travel from institutions that span hospitals and assisted living facilities and hospice, we have a contraption that sort of speaks to different levels of mobility, right? So like more mobile and very much less mobile as that elder person comes closer and closer to death. We're actually in two venues. We're doing a small venue and a large venue. So our small venue is Community Music Center, and that is January 25th through 27th. And then the following weekend, we are in Lincoln Recital Hall, which is the classical music venue below Lincoln Hall. And those shows are February 2nd and 3rd.
You're listening to Stage and Studio on KBOO Portland. I'm Joseph Gallivan, standing in for DeMay Roberts. And this week, we're talking about the Fertile Ground Festival. My guests are Nicole Lane, Bill Wadhams, Sansom Siroth, Erin Wheeler Kay, and Jessica Wallenfels. So, Erin, you're with Echo Theatre, and that's Contemporary Circus Theatre, and you're presenting two shows. One's called It's Like This, and the other one's called Underneath. Tell us a bit about It's Like This.
It's Like This is a collaboration between Echo Theatre Company artists and a local composer named Miles DeBastion of Sima Space, who is a deaf composer, and he specializes in creating access for deaf and hard of hearing audience members by using visual and vibrational components in his composing.
Right, so you're going to have these kind of speakers that just vibrate.
Yeah, they're called a transducer plate. They're very low frequency generators, and Miles uses them as a textural component in his composing. So we're bolting them underneath the risers, and then they're cued by the band.
Will everyone feel them?
I believe so.
They're not like super subtle, like you don't even notice them.
No, well, I mean, all sound is a sensation of movement, right? So it's a pressure wave moving against your eardrum, but some frequencies are low enough you feel them in your tissue, in your body. Well, we don't do any aerial work above people in this show, but in front of them, we're using the entire space, the entire three-dimensional space. So we use rigging components to give us access to movement we can't do without them. And I would say in our portion, three out of the five movements involve an aerial component.
Is there much of a story to It's Like This?
Well, what question we were exploring is, what is the process like of meeting the other, and what happens when you get past your initial response to the other and live with them for a while, and what are the potentials of that? So that's the underlying thread, and we have five different imaginary creatures. At this point, they're not tied to a specific narrative. It's more like a visit to a menagerie where you might be, or environments in which things are living and you're getting to be with them.
What kind of creatures do you mean?
This has been a bit of a challenge, both in translating, we're working with a deaf dancer, and so in translating concepts that are a mix. So one creature is sort of like an anemone insect, like kind of a spider anemone. Another is kind of like a hermit crab that lives in a glowworm tube, but when threatened, it comes out, and it's kind of a lobstery sort of thing, although these are just placeholders. There's two creatures that share a single tail, and it's made of a bungee material, and so that piece is very comic, but kind of about when you have multiple impulses inside a creature and how they coexist.
So these are all dancers in costumes.
Yes, aerialists, dancers, people who kind of live, as some of the other guests said, in the overlap of movement, expressive arts. It's a nonverbal piece.
The sense of the other, is this sort of psychoanalytic other? Is it very academic, the thinking, or is it just like,
well,
you know,
Echo
meeting
Theater,
new people kind of other?
I think there's so many ways of being the other or being otherized. I think other is not something you necessarily adopt for yourself when you're first learning about it, if you're the other. It's something you experience by the way you're treated. We've been trying to increase our understanding of access in across the spectrums of humanity and ways of being. And as I've gone further and further into learning about different ways of being, I've found that I still stumble up against my initial response to things sometimes, and I need the reminder that whatever my initial response might be, once I sit with this person, or sometimes not a person, you know. And I think that, like what makes a person stare? It could be beauty. It could be something grotesque to them. It could be something that they just want more information and they're curious about it. And I think a good question is, okay, now that you've stared, now what? Because I think people stop at staring and then either look away or just don't look past the initial take on something. So they objectify it as beautiful or grotesque or other. And so I think it is a metaphysical question, but it's directly in our lives because we're living in diverse times, and the emerging diversity or the emerging awareness. We've always been in diverse times, but I think things are less siloed, and there's people being courageous enough to be living visibly more, and there's more space for them to do so. And so we need practice, I think, meeting the other and celebrating the potential of incorporating their way of being into our way of being.
Can you handle all this in a short stage show? It's a huge concept.
I agree. I don't think that I'm trying to convince anybody of anything or arrive at a conclusion. I want to open up a place to examine these ideas. And the other access point, in addition to deaf audience members, is multi-generational viewers. And so I think a question is, what is the space where four-year-olds and elders and everyone in between can look upon something together and have something in common there, or have the diversities of what they're experiencing be held in a container? I think live performance can do that. I think we can do that in a half hour.
Yeah, and without words, I mean, are people going to really get – they're not going to get a message. What do you think they're going to get? That's the feeling?
You know, who goes to theater? What will they get out of it? I mean, they'll be out of the house. We're agreeing to be objects in front of them. And so we have an agreement already that they're going to come see something and we're going to show them something. So what they get out of it is a bit on them. But what I'm putting into it is a great deal of care and consideration for their point of view. So I think that they will be finding humor. I think they will be finding wonder The other thing about the other is it's wonderful. It's fascinating. And so